it's only been in the last couple years I've really started to open up and talk about it, because even as a provider, a licensed provider, it does feel edgy and it does feel stigmatized.
I'm Amelia, a former police and ambulance dispatcher and journalism grad.
I'm Rebecca, psychotherapist, author, and educator.
I'm Kathy Ann, and I'm a therapist.
Welcome back to The Other Side of the Call. Last week, psychotherapist Brittany Stewart helped us break down EMDR, what it is, why it works, and how it's changing the landscape of trauma recovery for first responders. Today, we're picking up right where we left off. In part two, Brittany takes us deeper into psychedelic-assisted therapy, the difference between recreational and supervised use, and how low-dose ketamine can safely support EMDR and IFS work. She also shares a powerful client story that shows what true long-lasting change can actually look like. If you're joining us mid-series, feel free to jump back to part one, which was episode six, but you'll be able to follow along either way. Let's get into it. A warning before we begin. This episode includes detailed discussion of trauma, trauma therapy, dissociation, childhood trauma, sexual abuse, military and first responder injuries, moral injury, and the emotional and physical effects of psychedelic-assisted therapy. We also touch on suicidal ideation, though not in graphic detail. If you're currently struggling, this may be activating. Please take care of yourself in whatever way you need. Step away, come back later, or skip this episode entirely. If you're in crisis, call 988 anywhere in Canada. If you're a first responder in Ontario or Alberta, consider boots on the ground. And elsewhere in Canada, look for Wings of Change, peer support, all of which can be found online.
I do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I did my trainings actually in California. And so my trainings are through Embodied Life Therapy, Lauren Taus, and then Three Cup Psychedelics, which is Lauren Taus, Melissa Whippo, and Sunny Strasberg. And so that's for ketamine therapy, psychedelic therapy. And then I'm trained specifically in MDMA-assisted psychotherapy and psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy. And that's through Therapsil. And that was done here in Canada.
You're the second person we've had on this season who has talked with our listeners about psychedelic assistant therapy. You know, I really do think that it's a growing option for people, and it's a viable one. And I do know that we're making headway with having it be more accessible in Ontario. I know that it's not something that we can access very easily here in Ontario, but I know that it's growing across Canada. It's becoming more and more of a accessible thing. Like through psychiatry, like this is, you know, it's not just because it's actually like a medical thing that's coming on board with it. So I really love that. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the stigmas around it, all of that sort of thing. What are your perspectives on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's still, it's so interesting. And you know, I got trained in ketamine assisted psychotherapy 3-4 years ago. And, you know, it's only been in the last couple years I've really started to open up and talk about it, because even as a provider, a licensed provider, it does feel edgy and it does feel stigmatized. And so that's not just a feeling of the client or someone like exploring these options. It's also has been part of my work, right, to look at. And I think so much of it comes back to just the conditioning that we've received for years and years and years around drugs and psychedelics. And I don't know if you remember that old school commercial, like the Friday.
This is your brain. This is your brain.
Yeah, that one.
Right. Nancy Reagan.
Totally. And it's those types of messaging, right? Or police officers coming into our schools as kids and talking about that. And so, you know, there is so much stigma. I also think there's a lot of barriers to being able to do research, right? Like, you know, these are still illegal in many, many, many places. And so people like MAPS who are wanting to do these real and who have done significant, beautiful research are getting shut down, right? So it's like we can't really do the research to teach the people to break those stigmas. It just feels like there's just so many barriers.
There is actually an undergraduate degree now, I think, at the U of Ottawa in psychedelics.
Yeah.
You know, so back to the stigma thing. So I think that, you know, there's mainstream media and the so many people have so much access to different channels that talk about promoting it and not promoting it. We had witnessed Matthew Perry's death that brought a lot of fear related to ketamine and the use of ketamine. What do you wish that people understood more about the perspective, or what do we need to do to shift the public's perspective on any of the things we've talked about today?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, the way that we use it in our work, in a therapeutic container, in a therapeutic setting, is not the same as the way people are using it recreationally. And so I can speak to like a personal story around that. When I went to do my MDMA training in Vancouver, and a part of that training, thank God, is that we do an experiential, because if you're going to sit people on these medicines, you need to know what it's like and you need to have experience with what can come up, right? And helping someone work through that. And so I had done MDMA a ton recreationally. And, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be the best time. I'm going to go outside and probably lay in the grass and touch my skin, dance. And, you know, I was like, I typically am someone who gets nervous before medicine work, like ayahuasca. I prepped for a year before, you know, so I was like totally relaxed. And it took me deeper than any medicine, including ayahuasca, has ever taken me before. It was incredible. I convulsed, which does not sound incredible, but like somatic, like shaking uncontrollably, releasing trauma from my body for 5 hours. It was like, I can't even explain how powerful that experience, and it was nothing like what I was thinking or what has happened to me at a rave dancing. Like, there is such a difference. And it goes, you know, that's why the importance of doing these things with trained professionals who really do focus on setting and dose, who can keep you safe, who do the medical assessment, right, to make sure there are no contraindications and this medicine is going to be safe for you, right, who when big things can come up can hold that container, who can provide you with the preparation and the integration. It is so important. But after that experience, I will never, or I don't know if I should say never, but it would be very difficult for me to do that recreationally again. Mm-hmm. It's so sacred. But yeah, just it's so sacred and it's so special. And I see it now as a medicine, right? And people even who use cannabis regularly, who then start to use cannabis in their healing, right? We offer we have an incredible facilitator on our team who offers cannabis-assisted breath work and, you know, cannabis meditation. And so a lot of people find that once doing it in a very therapeutically intentional way, it changes it for them. Yeah. It's completely different.
Well, because I think a lot of people use it recreationally, even though we're using that word, so I'm going to air quote it.
Yeah.
It's actually one of those firefighters or one of those managers at play, right? It's not technically recreational. We're doing it for some sort of escape from something.
Yeah, you're masking something.
Yeah, and so I love the idea of, you know, shifting that perspective. And as you said on some of your previous journeys, like, it was really important for you to have the experiential experience, what yourself, like you as the therapist or practitioner, should know exactly what can possibly happen for a person. Gabor Mate talked a lot about this in his journey through trauma therapy. And he used to take people on retreats and he'd take them to Peru to do ayahuasca and all these other things. And one of his first retreats, he was pulled aside by one of the medicine men. And they said, you should not be leading these people. And he was shocked. He said, at first, my ego was at play. I was like, what do you mean? I've been doing this. I'm a practitioner. I'm trained as a psychotherapist. I'm a psychiatrist. Like, what do you mean I shouldn't be leading these people? And the guy sat him down very respectfully and said, well, you are walking trauma that you haven't dealt yourself. And he said, I instantly stopped all retreats. I started working with that medicine man one-on-one, and he did his work and he did the experiences and he went through his own trauma. And then he reenacted or started reactivated his retreats and started, you know, working with people, but he needed to do it himself. He was putting his trust in the practitioners for sure, for his clients, but he was leading these people with no perception on what they were actually experiencing because he was carrying his own traumas he hadn't processed. So I think he talks a lot about your very point, right? That we need to understand firsthand what is going on. And this goes back to, I think, about our ethics in CRPO. I remember doing my master's and being, the messaging was clear that you shouldn't work in the same area that you've had experiences in. So I steered clear of all the areas and tried to just do general therapeutic services. And everything that was showing up every day for me was a mirror to everything I'd experiences. My clients were having the same experiences that I had in my life path. And so then I kind of threw that aside and was like, I need to do this, but I needed to make sure I was okay with mine. And that's the safe use of self that we all talk about, you know, in our practices. But this applies. It applies to whatever therapies you're bringing into your practice, right?
Totally.
And I think that that's also a really important thing to say in regards to talking about preparation and dosing and practitioner choice and all those things.
Yeah.
You know, when you're interviewing somebody to be your guide through these types of therapies, it's important for you to really know what that person has experienced before you hire them to be your guide, because there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh yeah, I'm trained in this, because it is a money-making container for the people who run these big corporations to train people in this stuff.
Totally.
So if those practitioners haven't done their own work, it's going to show eventually in your therapeutic journey too, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that was a really great point to bring up. And
no, that's amazing. And I so resonate, right? You can only take people as far as you've gone yourself. And so going back to your question, right? It's like, what would you suggest they ask? Thank you. Right? It's like, yeah, even with EMDR, the question too is like, have you done EMDR?
Yeah.
Right? Or what was your experience, right? Because it is so important that we are doing our own work as healers. And it's interesting, part of why I got my Reiki training wasn't for other people. It was actually for myself, because I'm very empathetic and especially in ketamine work or psychedelic work and, you know, EMDR too, a lot of it is somatic, like where you see purging or belching or yawning. And so energetically, I had to learn how to not take that on and home with me. And so I had to learn some really good practices, right? But yeah, it's for anything, right? EMDR, ketamine, asking those questions, like, what has this looked like for you and your journey? Yeah.
Becca, you mentioned a bit of jargon there. I know what it means, but for our listeners, what is CRPO?
A governing body for psychotherapies.
The College of Registered Psychotherapists of Ontario.
Same bodies in other provinces across Canada. Yeah.
For the most part. Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah. Some provinces have different rules, but generally every practitioner has a governing body that protects the clients.
This has been a very fascinating conversation. And I'm curious, what is the effectiveness of EMDR, ketamine use, and the combination of it? So what does your client get out of it? What changes for them?
And I guess if I could just sort of tack on to that, Do you have a story without breaching confidentiality that captures the impact of these therapies?
Yes.
A success story?
So first, I think it's really important just to kind of tell listeners, because there really is a difference in the way that we work with ketamine therapy. So, you know, there is high dose ketamine work, which is more of like what you would think a classic psychedelic experience of someone in a journey. And you know, they get the eye mask and the headset and they're kind of like in this altered state. And then there's low dose ketamine work. And so I just want to state that the way that I mostly work in my practice is low dose ketamine work. Okay. And so the client can still sit, They can get up, go to the washroom if they need to, you know, unassisted. They can, you know, still communicate. They can be external. It's kind of like this internal, external experience for them where they may be more quiet and like, you know, having some things that they're working through on their own, but then they can come out and we can sort of unpack that together. And so that is the type of work that I do, because I think that type of work marries best with trauma, PTSD, complex trauma. So what do we know about PTSD, right? It's like we very often, going back to IFS, people with PTSD, and I can relate to this personally, is that we have these parts that really like to be in control, because trauma, by definition, is things happening outside of our control, right? And so I think the worst thing that we can do with people with PTSD or complex trauma is just shoot them off into some, you know, completely different realm, right? That, like, that can be really, really scary for these protector parts that have worked so hard for so long to keep them safe. And so that's not the way that I personally like to work. I like to be, I really slowly titrate into this work. Okay. So when I do low dose ketamine, I'm actually doing EMDR and IFS in this session. And so I might use EMDR as preparation before ketamine therapy, because it could be an incredible way to, you know, clear out some stuff. We can do EMDR and IFS with some parts that are really nervous about the ketamine treatment and do some work there. I also think it's like doses. So talk therapy is kind of like a dose. And then we bring in EMDR. That's a bit of a higher dose. Then we're bringing in psychedelics. That's a really high dose. And so, it's really interesting. Some people will come for ketamine treatment, but then we'll do EMDR and they'll be like, holy shit, that was incredible. And we don't actually need to go into the psychedelics. We can just do the EMDR. So I'm very mindful about least intrusive work, and I will always start someone with EMDR if they've never done that before introducing ketamine treatments. And the other thing too is, right, when our systems are exposed to too many new things at once, that can be really overwhelming. So if I'm going to do ketamine with someone, I want their system to at least know what an EMDR session looks like. What does it like look like when we add IFS with that EMDR? So that when we go into the medicine work, the only new thing that we're introducing is ketamine. And so reasons that I might bring ketamine into clients that I'm working with, like why I may think that's a good option or an appropriate option, is when we, again, going back to IFS, I see very often, and not being stereotypical, but there's, you know, very often within the military first responder population, they have these really strong protectors. A lot of people do. People who've had childhood trauma, sexual abuse, like, you know, very complex trauma, really strong protectors. If you think about, you know, like first responders, paramedics, military correctional officers, who by definition, they're a guard, yeah. Right? They have to have certain parts or else they can't do their job. You can't go into these calls, like you can't see those things without having a dissociative part that helps you check out. Like you just can't do that work. It's such big work. And so these parts are really adaptive at times on the scene when we need them to be. Right? Because we can't walk in and we can't be, you know, I'm not a first responder, but I could imagine going into a call and then feeling really, you know, emotional and not being able, because you're then not able to do your job. You're not going to be able to save someone, and you might actually put yourself in danger or your partners. So these protectors are very adaptive in their work. But then they become maladaptive and they don't know when to separate and they can't tell work from, you know, regular relationships, like what's safe, what's not. And so it really comes into play in EMDR and can act as a barrier, to be quite honest, because they don't know how to let those parts go. And so that's where I'll bring in the IFS to really work with kind of softening these parts, getting to know them, getting permission from the person's system to even do the work in the first place, creating the safe container. But then if we're doing EMDR and things are just really stuck or the client has a really small window of tolerance and they're just going into hypoarousal and completely shutting down or dissociating or distracted, or they're going into hyperarousal and they're having panic attacks or something, ketamine might be a really good option to bring in, because what it's actually going to do is that's actually going to soften those protectors so that they're not right. They're still there. We're not trying to get rid of them. They're still around, but they're not as intense and there's more access to self and the window of tolerance is able to expand a little bit. So we can actually get in and do some really beautiful trauma work and processing work and then gently come out. And it's kind of this really slow, like, titration process, if that's making any sense.
But I think that that was really a really good point to make about what happens in order to get to the answer of her question, which is, how do people then, what's the outcome look like for someone who did all of that with you?
Right, right. Well, the outcome, it really doesn't make a difference whether it's just EMDR or ketamine treatment, right? Like, if I'm doing ketamine and EMDR, the outcome is hopefully what their intention was when they came into the space, right? When they started this process, what is someone's intention? Okay, I want to have more, I want to feel more confident. I want to be sleeping better. I want to be experiencing less nightmares and flashbacks. I want to be able to have a healthy relationship. Really, the outcomes are what the intention is, what the issues are. That's what we're treating with these different approaches, and that looks different for everyone. So it's really hard to answer that question specifically. But yeah, what I find mostly in especially compared to maybe traditional talk therapy is that the outcomes are quicker. You know, EMDR, it really is speedier than talk therapy. And the results, the research is showing, they're long lasting. It's very efficient.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So
that was beautifully said.
Yeah. So yeah. There can be so many results. It's really hard to say, but back to your story about, or sorry, your question about a story without breaching confidentiality.
Easier said than done. Sorry to put you
on the spot. No, that's okay. I have so many, but, the one that really comes to mind is there was a client we actually just wrapped up recently, and this client really truly had every type of trauma that you could think of. So originally came from military, job-related, work-related trauma. Also had experienced a ton of childhood trauma, relational trauma, sexual abuse, attachment trauma. And so very complex system. Right. And I don't say that in a bad way or a judgmental way. I have a very complex system, but just lots of different stuff. Right. And so, this woman, she had done lots of therapy in the past. Most of the therapy she had done with someone else was more about like containment and safety and stability type work. And so she had really contained things. Like, she had contained them so much, they were pushed into a little box and she never wanted to look at them again. So
very efficient little robot.
Right. So that works until it doesn't. And so she had came to me for EMDR specifically, and it took us, I want to say we worked together for about 2 years. So her system was very complex in the sense of, as soon as we would go, she had very strong protectors. And so as soon as we would kind of get into the work, it was like, nope, not happening. So a lot of our work was about building rapport and was slowly titrating. Maybe we didn't start with the really big work-related stuff. We started with some childhood stuff that felt a little bit safer. And so that was the theme we focused on first. And slowly over time, we started to kind of like, her system started feeling safer. Her part started trusting her more, that she was actually going to, you know, go home and do the integration, that she was going to check back in on them when she got home and not abandon them, because she was activating them. Like, they wanted to know, like, you're going to come back to me. And so over time, you know, it just, her window of tolerance continued to grow. She found herself, like, she was highly identified into this military community, very high achiever, like, didn't know what to do without that. And to see her evolve over time and find herself. And these traits I've always seen in her that maybe she didn't have, she didn't know were there. Like, she's so intuitive and spiritual, and she never had a container or an environment that she could really allow that to be present in the work that she's done in the past. And like, she is so confident now and so just like connected to who she really is at the core, at the root of her being. And we just finished an intensive. This is someone who probably couldn't do processing work for more than 30 minutes in a session. We just finished a week long, 6 hours a day, intensive Monday to Friday. And it was beautiful. And so I would say when I first met her, she had 4 pages written on all of her trauma, 4 pages of targets of things. And we just cleared out every single one. And she's done. Wow. And she's like, you know, I feel so called to exploring like different things, right? While resting and not jumping into something else. But, you know, to watch that type of transformation. And I really love being, I think it's so humbling. And like, I don't know what the word is. It sounds kind of weird, but it's beautiful to witness someone heal and their body letting go. And you know, even like the belching or the yawning or the shaking, like to watch that. And this client has built so much trust that we were actually able to do in our EMDR session. We were processing something with you know, some work-related sexual trauma that actually took back to some childhood stuff. And she was able to trust me enough to do this very somatic, you know, kind of movement-based exercise where I would kind of like stand up, but then I would crouch down, then I would go to the side. And she got to like listen to her body and what that was like and work through those triggers and activate, use her voice and kind of like corrective experience from her wounded inner child. And it was just incredible. So
beautiful.
It's just an honor to watch people become who they always were and who they were always meant to be before all this shit happened to them. It's incredible.
And I think that that is maybe a beautiful story of hope for anybody who's listening, who may have the same history that you've described this person having, you know, to be able to hear that there is, you know, another side of this. There's another side of the pain that is actually magical. Because I know you use the word beautiful, but I use the word magical because it is. And, you know, it's funny you said 2 years, because that's been my consistent data that I work with people for about 2 years. And it's like switch. It's just all of a sudden they just are in their essence. They're living authentically. They have their voice. They have their boundaries. They have their skills. They're regulating on a daily basis. They are doing all the things, and they have freedom in this world that once felt so constrictive and caged, right? And so I think you described that beautifully for our listeners to know that, you know, if you're thinking about wanting those feelings or your intentions are, I want to feel free, maybe try these things out, right? Because I do think that it's possible for people to achieve that, especially when they are ready to do it, right?
And I think that's the big thing too, right? Readiness will come into play. I also think it's really important, and we were talking a little bit about, I don't know who mentioned it, but like people hearing things about EMDR and you know, there is so much more on social media now, which is incredible. But I do see people calling all the time being like, I saw this on Grey's Anatomy or I heard Prince Harry talk about this. And it's like managing those expectations is really important because it is just a tool at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right. My clients, like my job, I feel like, is to get them to recognize and trust their own inner healing That's capabilities. Right. Mm-hmm. They are the fucking medicine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not 100%. The ketamine, right? Yes,
exactly. And guides.
Right?
We're the guides.
Totally.
We're just here to introduce you to the medicines, to the therapies, to the theories, to the mindsets.
Totally.
It's up to you to integrate it.
Totally.
Right?
And you will only get what you put in, right? So if you're not doing the integration, EMDR is not a magic spell. Like, it's not going to do all the things, right? You have to put in the work.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that it's important for people to understand that when we say integration, right, what I would describe that as is you're taking on a roller coaster with someone you trust, but you are literally feeling like you're dying through the entire process because you're killing off this old version of you that has all these adapted, maladaptive characters living inside of you who need to take a hike once and for all. But they can only do that through building the relationship with them, which I thought, I loved that you mentioned that, right? And so that it is a big choice to do this work. It is not a walk in the park.
No, if it was, everyone would be healed and we wouldn't be living in this predominantly sick culture, society, world, right? It's hard and it's, but it is worth it. Like to hear someone say, you know, Brett, every day since I was 9 years old, I've wanted to die. And for the first time in my life, I've gone, right? 2 weeks, even if it's just 2 weeks, without thinking about that once for the first time. And this woman's in her 60s.
Yep.
Like, right? And I believe in it because I've done these things and they've saved my life. Yeah.
I mean, I've tried a lot of different modalities. As you said, you know, I think that you have to try things out. You have to give everything an option. Right? Go and see how it feels for you personally. And if it feels right, then give it a go and really embrace it.
Brittany, I'd like to thank you so much for giving us a clear, compassionate window into EMDR and the possibilities of emerging therapies. You are literally changing how people understand trauma and recovery, and we are so grateful for your voice and your time today. How can listeners reach out to find out more about Spear Wellness and the fantastic work you're doing?
The easiest way would probably be to check out our website. So that is www.spearwellness.ca. Spear is SPEAR, wellness.ca. So you can, you know, it's pretty easily accessible. There's an intake and matching form if you are feeling curious. It has our team all listed on our website and our services. And you can connect with us or anyone on our team for a free consultation, and we can help get you set up with someone who'd be a good fit.
Check it out, guys. You can get all of this done to find the right practitioner. Mm-hmm. So spearwellness.ca, and look for Brittany or her brother, Zach. Yeah, he's the co-owner.
And we have a team of, I think there's 8 of us therapists. And then we have a whole other portion of holistic wellness providers, massage therapy, Reiki, somatics. Yeah, tons. Yeah.
It's all at spearwellness.ca. And this isn't a commercial. We just love what Brittany's doing.
Wellness.
Yeah.
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 Brittany, thank you for your clarity, your compassion, and your honesty today. You helped take something that can feel intimidating, EMDR, IFS, psychedelic-assisted therapy, and you made all of those things more understandable, practical, and hopeful. If you want to learn more about Brittany's work or explore therapy options with her team, head to spearwellness.ca. That's S-P-E-A-R, wellness.ca. For our listeners, if today's conversation gave you something to think about or gave you a bit of hope, please share this episode with someone in your circle. And don't forget to leave a rating or review. Your support helps us reach more first responders, more families, and more clinicians who need these conversations. And a quick reminder that Voices of Valor is always open for submissions. If you ever had to call 911 and you'd like to thank a first responder who showed up for you, let us know. Or alternatively, if you are a first responder and you'd like to share a short reflection, a lesson learned, or a moment that changed you, you can send your voice note or recording to us at amelia@tosopod.com. That's A-M-E-L-I-A at T-O-S-O-P-O-D.com. And before we wrap, let's take a moment to settle the body.
Giving yourself a nice warm hug also helps calm your nervous system. So put your right hand underneath your left armpit and put your left
hand on your right shoulder and squeeze your body. And this warm hug will help soothe your vagus nerve, and do this for definitely over 20 seconds. Another thing to calm yourself down is to say voo, and just say voo for as long as you can. So voo, go ahead.